Hi, I'm WTOP entertainment editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by filmmaker Matthew Whitecross, who is the director of the new Showtime documentary series, a four-part series called The Kings, which is all about the four kings of the 80s boxing, Roberto Duran, Marvin Hagler, Tommy Hearns, and Sugar Ray Leonard. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I love this series. I thought I was going to, you know, maybe watch one episode a night throughout the whole Memorial Day weekend. And it turned out I sat down Friday night and just binged the whole thing, basically. I mean, it was so compelling.
Amazing.
Congrats off the bat. I guess before we get into, you know, all the specifics, just big picture it for me. Why did you think now was a good time to sort of look back at this era of 80s boxing? I mean, these guys sort of continued that Ali popularity in the 80s.
Yeah, it's an amazing era that I, to be honest, coming on board the project, I didn't know a huge amount about. Like you said, everyone knows Ali and everyone knows the period that comes after with Tyson. At least in the UK, I think fewer people know about this era of the Four Kings. So that made it immediately attractive. But I think what I was seeing a lot politically, you know, I grew up in the 80s and I remember politically a lot of things happening that felt like they had a resonance with what was going on now. You know, you had the a certain part of the civil rights struggle, not the famous part, but that continued. But then you also had, Reagan coming in. And I think there are certain connections I can see between his style of campaigning, his populism, and the way that Trump connected with people as well. So there certainly seemed to be some, for me, uncomfortable resonances politically. And what I loved about the way that Showtime and the producers, their take on this material was like, look, we want to talk about the boxing and why it was important, but we also want to look at the bigger picture. Like, why do people box? What's the significance of all this? Why are we telling this story? And what was happening culturally, socially, politically in the background? So that for me was really compelling because I felt like these guys were symbols in a kind of a way for that era, but in a less, maybe in a more complex way, maybe less obvious way than Ali and Tyson later.
Oh, I mean, it's very admirable how you weave it in. And I mean, I know we're an all news radio station in Washington, D.C., so I'm sure we have listeners of, you know, of all political stripes, and I'm sure they will react in their own predictable ways, you know, depending on. But regardless of your political stance, like, I really do think you did a masterful job of weaving in with Roberto Duran coming from Panama. I mean, that's a direct tie to what's going on with the Panama Canal. You know, you sort of paint Sugar Ray Leonard as, you know, you sort of tie him to, you know, the Reagan, you know, populism, you know, patriotism in a way. But sort of show, you know, how that sort of all crumbles by the end of the decade. And as this era of boxing is starting to fade out, like, you really masterfully wove that, my friend. Speak to some of those political tie-ins that you drew.
No, it was the ambition from the beginning, really, to try and connect these four boxers to the backdrop and to talk about what they might represent as symbols, about the connections they made to the people. You know, I think in the case of Tommy Hearns, for example, he was Mr. Detroit. He was someone who at a very, very bad time for the city seemed to symbolize some hope, some sense of a renaissance, of rebirth, of the fact that, you know, they could pull it together again. In the case of Leonard, you know, I think that boxing was going through a bad time after Ali. He was on his way out, and suddenly there was this new golden child who was beautiful, was charismatic, was immensely skillful in the ring, and he had all those qualities. So he seemed to be like the heir apparent to Ali. But I think, and then when you have Hagler was like a working class hero. And in the case of Duran, like you said, he was the Panamanian symbol for the whole of Latin America. So you had these guys who represented much more than just what happened in the ring. And for me, you know, I came from, my parents were refugees. They came to the UK, and politics was something that we grew up with. And I think politics, as we see now, is everywhere. You know, I think in some ways, maybe in the US for a few years, and certainly in the UK, people became a bit closeted. The idea that politics was something that happened to other people in the good times. Then I think in the last few years, we started to realize, no, politics permeates everything. It touches every single aspect of our lives. And so I certainly felt that about the Four Kings. You know, with Ali, everyone knows Ali was the symbol for the civil rights movement, you know, rightly or wrongly. Obviously, he's more complex than that, but that's what he's come to represent. And I think Tyson afterwards represented a certain kind of excess and brutality of the era that came after the Kings. But with the Kings, it's in some ways more interesting. You know, it's more murky. They each represent something else, the dizzying highs and the devastating lows. And for me to have 4 hours to really get stuck into that, which Showtime allowed us, was amazing.
Absolutely. I want to go more into each of the four fighters. I mean, I know the series itself moves chronologically, and very smart to do that, because, I mean, as a viewer, that works best. But stepping outside of that for a second and just talking, you know, I want to talk about each of these four guys individually. What were their, you know, either strengths in the ring or things you learned about them even outside the ring? So let's start with Sugar Ray Leonard. I mean, he obviously is the most famous, and he's got our, you know, local tie. We're here in DC, and he was just outside of here in Maryland. Talk about what you learned about him. He was sort of the poster child, the golden boy, but a lot more going on with Sugar Ray Leonard when we see this documentary.
Yeah, I think Ray Leonard is someone who came from the wrong side of the tracks, had a very tough upbringing. But because somehow when you contrast him to Duran especially, but even the other two, he was considered by a lot of people, I think unjustly, as being somehow white collar, being middle class, being fake. And actually he was, you know, he was as skillful or more skillful than any of them. But he got tarred with this idea that because he was beautiful, he was charismatic, that he was somehow cheesy, that he wasn't a real boxer, he didn't have a real grit. You only have to look at the endings of some of those fights. I mean, if you look at, well, the second Duran fight, or if you look at certainly the first Leonard Hearns fight, he's someone who has this inner steel, which is unbelievable. I think possibly more than any of them, he exhibited that in the ring. But he had his inner demons, you know, and I think this happens with a lot of people, a lot of people in the public eye. And he had this outward image of being a family man, of being very smooth, of being very charming. But I think behind closed doors, there was a very different side to him. You know, I think it's not unusual for people in his position. And he's been admirably open about it. He's talked about this stuff in the past. He had a lot of conflicting things. You know, he'd come from poverty. He'd been abused as a child or as a young man. And he ended up having a lot of problems with drugs and so on. So, you know, these are all things that we tried to touch on along the way, tried to describe someone in the round. You know, I think like most people, you know, these guys are heroes and they have their downside as well. You know, so I think what was wonderful about having 4 hours is you get to try and describe them in the round. You know, you show them as complex individuals.
Absolutely. All right. And then let's move on to Marvelous Marvin Hagler, because, man, I mean, you can't tell the story of Sugar Ray Leonard without seeing those reaction shots of Hagler in the crowd, especially, you know what I mean? That event where you think they're going to announce the big final showdown between them, and Leonard says, but it's never going to happen. I'm going to retire now. And Hagler's just left there, you know, with egg on his face. And there's so many, and even when they fought, I mean, when you watch the documentary, you kind of feel bad for Hagler. I mean, it was a decision in the end that, you know, that they gave to Leonard, but a lot of people thought Hagler won that last fight. And then he just, you know, retires that. He doesn't stick around too long. But explain sort of the marvelousness of Marvelous Marvin Hagler.
Yeah, I mean, Hagler is one of those guys who I think felt himself shortchanged often by life and by the critics and by the fans. And sometimes I think justly so. You know, he didn't have the glamour. He didn't have the glitz of someone like Leonard. And he was often, you know, unjustly ignored. You know, certainly on his way up, he had to fight, you know, his first fight was for $40. And then you contrast that with Leonard. Leonard's first fight was for $40,000 and he was on primetime TV. He'd gone up through the Olympics and, you know, Hagler said he couldn't do that because he was trying to support a young child. So he ended up doing it the other way. I mean, it's all arguable. You know, when you look at Leonard had really some tough blows on the way up. It wasn't like he had an easy route. It just seemed easy for Hagler, I think. Hagler was like, you've had all the breaks on the way up and you've had all the publicity. And so there was always that rivalry between them, which is fascinating dramatically for us. You know, you can see it there all the way back to the beginning. One of them gets to go supposedly the easy route via the Olympics. Then one of them gets to go professional in the, you know, in the glare of the and the limelight of primetime TV. And then when they finally about to sign the deal and do their big fight, which is going to be Hagler's big payday, then Leonard backs out unexpectedly and it's all done on his terms. So Hagler always had that chip on his shoulder with Leonard, and it carried him all the way through to that final fight. And I mean, that's why it's so devastating to watch, I think. And especially if you're a Hagler fan, if you're part of his family and his entourage, you know, it came down to judges' decisions, and judges' decisions are often controversial. And that was one of the most controversial in history.
Yeah, especially also knowing that, you know, he just passed away too this year, and you know, you dedicate the film to him at the end. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like Hagler comes out, I think he comes out looking really good of all four. I think when you watch, I think you could kind of look back and say, Dang, he might have been just the keep your head down, straight ahead workman, you know, that emerges. You know, you might look back and say, dang, he might have been the best, you know, of all of them. But all right, well then
I agree. I mean, I think with Hagler, it's interesting that obviously as you make a documentary like this, there's all kinds of moments that seem very important at the time and they end up having to lose just because of length. And I think his decency shone through a lot of that material. And particularly, I mean, he was given a lot of chances where people were saying, look, take the easy money or maybe ditch your manager and trainer. You know, they're slowing you down. And even in that last fight, I think he was offered an opportunity to make more money at their expense. And he turned it down. He almost threw the whole fight just saying, look, he's kind of sickened by the corruption in the business. And he was someone who was a straight arrow. He wanted to do things the right way. So I think of all of them, he's the most decent and honest for sure.
He seemed like the most principled in terms of, I'm not going to stick around longer than I need to just for a payday. My work in the ring speaks for itself. I mean, I regardless of which of the four is your favorite, you definitely will come away from this thing admiring Hagler for sure.
Definitely.
All right. Well, then when you mentioned Hagler, of course, you can't say the sentence without Hearns, because, man, Hagler Hearns, that probably the most exciting first round in boxing history. I mean, if there's any younger viewers that, like, I know you grew up in the 80s, I grew up in the 80s. So like, I actually sadly didn't get to see this live. I had to watch, you know, a replay of it, but man, go on YouTube now if you're younger and check it out. You're not going to find a better round in boxing history or a better first three rounds. I think it was a three round, knockout. It's insane.
That's right.
But
speak to
Tommy Hearns. You mentioned he's like, you know, coming up from Detroit and had the whole city behind him. But talk about how he fancied himself as, you know, he could be a boxer, you know, the sweet science sort of thing. But man, oh man, he had that right hand. He had power.
Absolutely. Well, I think with Tommy, it's funny. You get to meet him and spend time with him. He is a gentle giant. So his appearance, his ferocious appearance, his size, you know, a lot of people used to call him a freak, but in that sense, even his friends were saying he is a kind of a freak of nature in that you shouldn't be that tall and that agile and have that kind of reach and be a lighter weight. It seems impossible, but he somehow disobeyed all those rules. And he was someone who started out, like you said, having that kind of thing where he was just about a kind of, you know, pick and poke, just trying to get jabs and so on. And then he just developed this devastating right punch, which was taught to him by Manny Stewart, his trainer and manager. And their relationship, I think, is the key for me to understanding Tommy, because he was someone who really didn't like the limelight. He was very shy, didn't enjoy that space, but then he blossomed under Manny Stewart. And yeah, when you see some of these fights, I mean, this was seen as possibly the key to his, you know, why he became such a great boxer, but also why he had some of these losses, was that if you're someone who can knock people out within seconds of a fight, you never really learn the stamina which you need to survive against someone like Hagler or even Leonard. And so I think that seemed to be his Achilles heel. What made him so great was also what brought him down in the end, because he had never really been forced to go the distance. Whereas someone like Leonard, it was routine for him to go the whole 15 rounds. And Hearns, when it came to it, whether it was versus Leonard on that first fight or with the second one with Hagler, that seemed to be the deciding point. But having said that, you know, I think if you talk to Tommy now, he was like, I could have kept on going. He has that true grit and determination that a champion needs. And I think even now, you know, when I saw him last, Marvin hadn't passed away. He was like, I'm determined. We've got to go back. We've got to go. I deserve a rematch. So he was still, even just a year ago, still determined to get back in the ring with Marvin.
Yeah, I mean, he comes across really like him too, I think. And, you know, especially dealing with, you know, what happened with his brother. It's a lot of the outside of the ring stuff too, that he was, you know, able to just battle through and deal with in the ring. And then I think of all of them, it really shows the ability to bounce back from defeat. You know, I mean, after the Hagler defeat, he really picks himself back up and sets new goals. You know, I'm going to be the first to win a title in three different weight classes. You know, there's a shifting of his outlook to say, you know what, I can make history in other ways. I think he's really admirable too.
100%.
And then last but not least, of course, Fist of Stone.
Yes.
Roberto Duran. Roberto Duran, man. Maybe the most fascinating, you know, enigmatic, charismatic, just crazy sort of individual here. Talk about what made him special, you know, carrying the hopes and dreams of a whole country in defeating Leonard the first time, but then also just the depressing a whole country with the no mas, and then the ability to just fight on and fight on.
Yeah, Duran is a force of nature. I mean, I've never met anyone like him, really. He's absolutely extraordinary. He's someone who just seemed to have like a kind of drive and an energy, which I guess came from the streets, came from his tough upbringing. You know, I remember him saying when we met, you know, you can't become a hero. You can't become a boxing legend unless you grew up poor. God only blesses the poor. And I think there's something about him. When you meet him now, it's like, I think he's mellowed, he's softened a little bit. But back then he was just ferocious and he could destroy people. And he took pleasure in doing damage to his opponents and really, really hurting them. But when you meet him now, he's hilarious. Like he's so much fun to spend time, you know, in this company. He used me, he was stopped, you know, his last fight was stopped just before, like a week or so before, I think he was in Argentina and he was involved in an almost fatal car collision. And that was the only reason he ever stopped boxing, because he physically just couldn't. He died on the operating table for about a minute. It was the only thing that could stop Roberto Duran. And he was still convinced he wanted to go back. But as a result, he's got kind of issues with his hips and so on. He refused to have any proper operation to deal with it. So he used me as a human crutch for a couple of days walking around London. And he's wonderful. Like, he's just full of great stories. There's nothing you can talk to him about that he says, no, that's off limits. But he seems to remember those moments, the highs and the lows, and he kind of treats them the same. It's just like, okay, this is part of my history. I don't have any regrets. I live in the moment, and my failings, the issues that I've had along the way, that's all part of the same story. You don't have the highs without the lows. So he seems pretty zen at the moment.
Oh yeah, and man, the amount of weight on his shoulders and burden he was carrying by not only, like you said, not only Panama, but the entire of Latin America too. I mean, they wanted to see him come in and beat Leonard, and he did. And he comes back a king, like right up there with, you know, the heads of states of their country. I mean, he's like the most significant, like a political figure in a way. And then which makes the whole no mas thing so much more, it's like gotta be one of the more baffling, perplexing things. I mean, in talking with him, did you sort of, I mean, what's your sense of why he just threw his hands up in that match? Was it more of just like, I'm not dealing with this guy, this clown that he called him? I mean, or was it frustration that he couldn't hang with him, or what was it?
I think so. I think frustration probably with a lot of things was the cause of the defeat and the no mas. You know, I think when I was talking to him, he was very, he gets asked this question, I'm sure, every single day of his life. Sure. But it was one of the times that I found him being most open and honest from, you know, in my experience. My family is from Argentina, like I said, so I could speak to him in Spanish. So I guess it was just easier to communicate. And I said, look, I'm sorry we have to go over this territory again. I'm sure you're sick of hearing it, but what do you think it was? And he was going back and said, you know what? I went in there, I got forced into that fight prematurely. I wasn't ready. The people who were supposed to be looking after me weren't looking after me. Then when I get in there, Ray Leonard doesn't want to fight me like a man. He wants to dance around. And he just got to a point where it was just too much. And I think, you know, like Steve Farhood says in the show, you know, a second later, he would have made a completely different decision. He didn't. It was something done in the kind of madness, moment of madness. And then seconds later, he obviously regretted it, realized what he'd done. But I think it was a combination of all these factors of thinking like, no, this isn't a real fight. This isn't an honorable fight, but it's just a different attitude. You know, I think in the ring, anything goes, and Leonard chose a different way to do it, which was to frustrate him. And that's a legitimate form of attack, but just not if you're Roberto Duran.
Yeah, but I still think, you know, what could have been a career low moment that could have ended anyone else. I mean, he was able to bounce back and win titles again, and you know, you see him, you know, score major victories throughout the rest of the documentary, fighting on like what I think he fought in like five different decades or something. So
yes, right.
Pure duration, Roberto Duran. Yeah, man, he's around. He's unbelievable, and just such a charismatic, you know, listening to those interviews with him, you know, him laughing while recounting stories in and out of the ring. It's like catnip for fans of boxing.
No, for me, I mean, it was amazing just to sit there with him. And yeah. He's hilarious. He's genuinely one of the funniest people I've met. But then he also is very passionate about what happens inside the ring. But he also has a sense of perspective that at the end of the day, you know, these are fights, you know, and of course they're important to people, but they are just fights. And then you go on to the next one. So he seems to be pretty, he has his head screwed on when he talks about it. Because I think the other three really live with a lot of regret later on in their life. They talk a lot about the losses and about things they should have done differently. Whereas Duran just seems to take it all in his stride.
Right, exactly. Thanks for, you know, going, recapping all four of them, you know, devoting time to talk about each one of them. But in terms of all four of them, you know, they're remembered as these four kings. They're sort of inextricably linked to one another. So as a filmmaker, when you're sort of, you know, you got to paint a mosaic with these four very different individuals, you know, interweaving in each other's lives and careers. Talk about how it's amazing how from a span of a decade that all four of them sort of have lay claim to, you know, defeating each other. One will lose to one, but then that person will beat the person that beat them. So, you know what I mean? They really all sort of have a claim to, like, you know what I mean? It's like a vicious circle.
Right. Yeah, I love that about them. And I think mosaic is exactly the right word. I think I'm going to use that from now on. We want to just start doing these interviews now. So I suppose... any one of them, you could easily make a 10-part mini-series about. I mean, there's no problem. There's no shortage of material. But I love the way they complemented each other. And I love the way, exactly like you said, that they fought each other 9 times. And each of them came out on top. Each of them drew. Each of them had their ups and their downs. And that's what makes it so dramatic and so compelling. You know, when I consider boxing, I think, like a lot of people, I have mixed feelings about it. You know, I can see what's incredible about it, but I can also see how damaging it can be in different ways to people. And these were four of the lucky ones, but even they didn't get out clean. So there's that side of things, which I think is fascinating from a documentary perspective. It's like, well, what are, you know, who are the heroes and are they villains too? And what are the highs and they also the lows? You know, I think what makes them great is in some ways what destroys them in the end. Not that any of them really came out exactly destroyed, but I think, you know, you even if you look at someone who got out early, like Marvin Hagler, he lived a lot of the rest of his life, I think, with some kind of regrets about that final fight. So, what I loved was that ability to step in and spend a bit of time with each and see how each complemented the next and try and dovetail those stories together. That was part of the challenge, but that was definitely what was most satisfying about the project.
Well, hats off, man. I think it's massively, massively done. And, you know, with these four fighters, I mean, there could have been a million approaches. You could have spent each episode, you know, this is the Leonard episode. This is the Hagler episode, Duran and Hearns. But I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad that you took us through a chronological journey, because it just allowed us as the viewers to see how they're interweaving with each other the entire time as history marches on, but also to weave in those political things in order. We get to see, you know, the nation and the world develop chronologically. I think it's just the smartest way you could have gone about it. So
thank you.
Good choice.
Thank you. It's good. Nice to hear. It's too late to change it now.
Yeah, right? No, I loved it. I can't say enough good things about it. I got to, as a filmmaker question, inside baseball, mm-hmm. inside boxing. Yeah. What was the piece of music that you used? I swear I've heard it. It's like a little unsettling sound. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's part in the score where you start to go into montages and it's like, almost like this, like, irritating, like, high-pitched violin. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, right. Yeah, well, no, that was actually Rael Jones, who's the composer that I normally work with. And it reminds you of something, but it was what I loved about this project, which I've always wanted to do with him and I've never had the chance before, was normally what happens, just because of the way, like, the schedules and money, is that you put in a temp score. And at the end, the poor composer comes in and you've so wedded to what you've already put in it's behind the temp cut that they have to come in and kind of match it. And anything they give you, you're like, yeah, it's good, but it's not what we had. And it's like, well, of course it isn't. That's why it's not why you bring a composer in, to just mimic someone else's style. And this time I said, look, if it's possible, I'd love you to start composing the music before we finish. And so I sent him a very rough cut of the first episode. And I said, look, can we get a theme for each boxer so we know who they are when they come in? And then in certain fights, I mean, hope, I don't know whether this stuff is all subconscious or whether people notice it as it happens, but as one fighter's winning, their theme starts overpowering the other. We had all these kind of things. We had a politics theme, or we had a kind of Panama theme, all these ideas. And depending on how things are going, then they go through different iterations and they morph. And so anyway, so he wrote all that stuff up front. So really when we finished the show, there was only a couple of things for him to tweak, but he had already written the score. So yeah, he did an amazing job. And if I can, I'd love to always work that way, because rather than getting to the end and go, and for me, music is, you know, if not the most important part, it's one of the most important pieces of the puzzle. And then to try and crowbar it in a couple of weeks at the end of the process is always, it's never quite satisfied me. So no, we were lucky.
Well, I from top to bottom, man, I think it's just great, great work. So I think any fans of boxing, definitely, but even just fans of history or politics or even filmmaking, will appreciate how you laid this thing out. So bravo.
Thank you.
Everybody.
Thank you so much.
It premieres this Sunday, June 6th at 8 p.m. on Showtime, four-part series starting this Sunday. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for making such a compelling piece of work. It really made my weekend. I'll definitely probably be watching it again soon.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for being a cheerleader for it. That means a lot to me.
Oh, absolutely. All right. We are going to speak with Teddy Atlas in a couple hours. So we'll see what he has to add here. So, but you gave me plenty to work with. So thanks, man.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listen there. Send my love to Teddy Atlas. He's such a wonderful guy, and he gave us so much of his time and his wisdom. So it was funny, because we went into that first, we did a one meeting with him where he came in for an hour, and it was the day after the birth of his granddaughter. So he was kind of sleep deprived and having far better things to do with his time. But he came in and gave us his time, and he was so good. I was like, oh God, we've got to get you back, Teddy. We've literally started scratching the surface and you've already got to go. And he said, okay, well, I normally just do it in one, but you know, we come back in a few weeks. So we came back and he was busy. So we went over to his house and said, yeah, what do you need? I think he thought I was going to do one more question. I think we finished about 6 or 7 hours later. So he ended up becoming a kind of unofficial narrator to the show. And you know, he lifted it to a completely different level. So thank him for me.
Oh, he's literally an atlas. He's an encyclopedia.
He certainly is. Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, and have fun interviewing him.
Will do. Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right, wicked. Well, thanks for the opportunity. We'll speak soon.